Sidiganjiri Nemato
Welcome back to Once Upon a Time in Wakanda. I'm Bo.
I'm Aaron.
And we are without our fearless leader, as he's got some family business going on right now. But our prayers are with T'Challa. Not T'Challa. I'm sorry. Wow. Freudian slip. Tyler. Prayers are with Tyler. With everything that he's got going on right now. Aaron James, it's been a while. We could pull back the curtain a little bit. It has been a while since you and I have heard each other's voices. And man, it is so good to hear your voice.
It is good to hear yours as well. And it is so good, man. I can't tell you how awesome it is right now and just how happy I am just to be back and to be back on a mic with you, man. Definitely missing Tyler, for sure. But this is just such an awesome thing right now just to be back on the mic with you guys, man.
Absolutely. Well, hey, all right. So we're about to dive into this movie. There's so many different angles that we could go about this. I think we're just going to take it character to character. And honestly, we got to start with kind of, you know, the crux of the entire movie, right? Like this is a Black Panther film without a Black Panther.
Yes. Yes. It was, man, you're sitting there and at the beginning, the manner in which Marvel did the intro, where it was that tribute and it was silent, which I thought was a very powerful moment at the very beginning of the movie. Think about it. When have we ever anticipated a sequel like this that we knew the main character that we had become accustomed to and admired and followed that was like this cultural icon, right? We knew he wouldn't be there. And yet the anticipation was still there. And the manner in which tribute was paid to him from the opening credit was just powerful. And I thought it was done well.
Yeah. You know, it was a bold choice. I remember thinking that during the silence, I was like, this is a bold choice because that is a long intro. You know what I mean? Like yes, that Marvel yes. logo is long. Mm-hmm. And so you were really sitting there. And I think if I'm remembering correctly, I feel like there was like a tribute, like I think it said like for Chadwick or something at the beginning of the movie prior to the logo. And then we go straight from that into the hospital scene. And no, I'm sorry. We go straight from that to a prayer.
Yeah.
To Shuri praying to Bast that if you save my brother, I'll never question your existence again.
Hmm.
Which is such a real, there's a lot. There's yes. a lot in that opening moment of that opening statement of that opening prayer. And then we go straight into the crisis mode of essentially what is not necessarily the hospital room, but is essentially kind of the, you know, they're working on trying to come up with a cure. And it's that ER type of feeling from a Wakandan level for sure. Okay. Mm. There's a lot to unpack in this.
Oh, without a doubt. For sure.
I don't want to speak for Tyler, but I will say I did get right out of it and I texted him. Or no, he got out of it. He saw it before I did. I texted him what he thought. He said, you know, I need to sit with it because it's hard to talk about without spoiling it. And it just really made me miss Chadwick. And I think that there's just a lot to unpack here. And there's just a lot of different components. The thing that ran throughout for me, I'm curious if you saw this as well, but like Shuri's arc of mourning without meaning. Like the challenge of mourning without meaning.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? What I'm saying is that like the cry out, she is always kind of represented in kind of this like diaspora of kind of opinions and thought leaders in kind of the Wakandan world. She's mm-hmm. kind of that progressive, tech focused. We don't need the old ways. We don't need tradition.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it's all about, you know, progressing things forward. And that's an interesting character to have as part of this, you know, kind of chorus of characters surrounding your main, right?
She definitely sticks out, right? That is a very stark contrast in the way that she is processing her grief, or at the beginning, we could say a lack thereof, right? And the manner in which everyone else is processing while they are processing their grief rooted in their faith in the deity and the traditions and the manner in which it's giving them a far more solid foundation, a lot clearer view in terms of their thinking and a path forward. And like you said, the mourning without meaning, it's definitely applicable. I think that's a perfect way to put it for her.
It's so interesting. And like, I felt that prayer, you know, like it's such a powerful way to start the movie. Cause like, I felt the earnestness. And I think that we all like, it's when you're pushed to a crisis, like you really are, no matter who you are, you could be like the most staunchly atheist person in the world, and you are crying out to the cosmos because you acknowledge your absolute loss of control in that moment.
Yes.
And for this to be the princess of the most powerful nation in the world, possessing the most powerful technology, the most powerful medicine, you know, we always talked about, you know, the notion of Wakanda has the cure to cancer, right? Well, clearly not, right? At least we're dealing with some sort of sickness that, you know, they never actually name it. But man, I also remember like just thinking how much I hate cancer. I hate the people. I hate that we continue to lose people to cancer. And we've seen cancer as an enemy to some extent in the MCU before, but we've never seen it take such a specific blow. And I guess I'm getting a little meta there as opposed to, you know,
No. No, you're absolutely right. It struck me like this whole, so I'm sitting there, right, at the beginning. And do you know who came to mind? Christopher Reeves. Because, you know, so Chadwick Boseman, an incredible actor, you know, one of the things that he is known for was just playing these just amazing historic, you know, people, right? In actual history, in actual life, whether it's James Brown or Thurgood Marshall, right? Or Jackie Robinson. So
icon after icon after icon.
Yeah, absolutely. Icon after icon, right? And so, but then like he did a phenomenal job playing all of those characters. But then, man, it's just none of them stuck and elevated culturally like him playing T'Challa. And the only person that I can compare him to with that similar dynamic is the manner in which Christopher Reeves is synonymous with Superman. I mean, Christopher Reeves, like back in the day, man, I know if you're younger and you're listening to this episode, you're like, I don't know who that is. You know,
right.
This gentleman, Christopher Reeves, man, he was Superman. Like the manner in which people would see T'Challa and give, you know, the Wakandan salute, you know, people would see Christopher Reeves and like, that's not Christopher Reeves, that's Superman. And then his tragic accident, which, you know, was a very public thing, and to watch him become a quadriplegic and ultimately tragically lose his life. I think that was, in my thinking, the only person that I could even begin to compare that to, that you have this this man, this artist who portrays a character that just causes this massive swell of pride, and then the manner in which the movies have been done in terms of representation and imagination about the possibilities and potential and all of those things, man. It was, again, just never seen that before. And I also say that I appreciate them for not shying away from it. They didn't. You know, sometimes something happens like in a movie franchise or just within the entertainment industry itself, particularly on screen, right? Where, you know, someone is lost and there's like, and then automatically moves on.
Right. Yeah. Recast or, you know, rewrite.
Yeah. And we recast, rewrite, move on. And there's very little just remembrance or felt effect after that person's exit.
Right.
And, you know, just sitting there and just taking this movie in, I felt like they, instead of running away from that, they leaned into it.
Big time. Okay. I will be honest, man. I've got complex feelings about that. I think from a narrative standpoint, I really appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And I think that the way in which they use it, I mean, like there's the discussion, the debate about, you know, recasting T'Challa, and we won't get into that right now, but I mean, like there's, you know, arguments to be made throughout there. But in terms of what you talk about, I think from a story standpoint, the way in which this, you know, they did lean into it, I think was beautiful. I want to be mindful about this, because like, I think that there's a lot of positivity in the fact that, especially with the beginning, with the funeral, kind of this homegoing, or, you know, Wakandan homegoing ceremony, and kind of giving kind of a cultural cathartic, you know, moment to mourn this seismic loss of this actor, this talent, and this symbol that Black Panther was and has become is important. And I think that was good. And I think that was really great. Part of what I think I've been feeling over the last several, I mean, over phase four as a whole.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like we have gotten so many tributes to Chadwick in What If, or, you know, at different kind of, you know, Marvel things, at Disney things, where it almost starts to feel like the mouse is monetizing grief. You know what I mean?
So
this is where the complexity comes in.
Yeah.
And so from a narrative standpoint, and kind of from what that provided, I feel that. I think that's really good. I think you're exactly right. But I felt like this was the time. And I think that one of the things that I've seen throughout in other different Marvel presentations, Disney presentations, and the way in which kind of Chadwick was, his death was, I want to be careful here, but almost kind of used as a marketing tool, felt awkward, I guess, is for lack of a better term.
Oh, I understand that completely. Yeah, for sure.
So I do think that the way in which they, you know, the story was structured, where everything was kind of, where Shuri was essentially kind of our point of view character. She was, you know, despite the fact that you do have all these characters that surround her, I thought her journey, especially in the first two acts of this movie, in processing that grief, the challenges that arose throughout, and then also just trying to figure out, I think, who she is. She's a side character that became a main character. That is a shock to the system. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
And I really think that for the first two acts of this movie, she played it so very well. And I think that arc in particular, I think she did a fantastic job with.
She really did. The evolution of Shuri from the cute baby sister genius to vengeful Black Panther I was like, wow. You know, and of course there was a lot in between. You know, in her development there, she did a phenomenal job. I thought it didn't feel rushed, right? It wasn't like it was, you know, it was like, no, it was in stages. You get that dynamic when you read a book, when you read a novel series, right? The development of a character, the maturity of a character, or you get it in a series. You know, like for all of you Breaking Bad fans out there, you know, or just shows like that where you see a character, and when you first meet them, you're like, oh, you know, everybody felt bad for Walt, you know, for everybody who's watched that show. And then by the time it's over, you're like, oh my gosh. and so to get that type of journey, not in a series, not in a novel, but in a movie, I thought that was done well.
Yeah. I was somebody early on that really was hoping that we would see her as Black Panther in the sequel. Even right after getting out of the theater for the first movie, I was like, oh, this is going to be, you know, and I was like, oh, what if she actually synthesizes perhaps like her own heart-shaped herb? And so you essentially have two Black Panthers, one that's going to be in Wakanda, and then one that's going to be kind of operating, you know, more out kind of globally and that sort of thing, which would be kind of an interesting structure. So I was looking forward to her becoming Black Panther. It was something I was super hyped for throughout.
Same
even
here.
Like, man, the predictions were like, okay, everybody's going to be Black Panther. No, like M'Baku's going to be Black Panther. Like, what?
No.
I won't name any names, but I saw a lot of like, M'Baku's going to be Black Panther. I'm like, no.
Yeah, I had that same anticipation, dude, because we know in the comics, Shuri does become Black Panther.
Right.
And has a phenomenal run, a very important place in Wakandan history and development through different wars, whether that's with Namor, Dr. Doom, you know, and others. And so she has an amazing place in Wakandan history and in Wakandan leadership. And so my desire was to see her take that mantle. I didn't want to see anybody else. Like, it was some crazy theories out there, bro. Like, you know, the talk of bringing, you know, oh, Killmonger really didn't die and this and that. I don't know if you heard that one, you know?
Oh, I heard that one. Yeah.
I was like, no, man, no. You know, it was like, no, I want to see Shuri take this and take this mantle and run with it. I was really excited to see that.
Well, and it was interesting, like, okay, so the chaotic nature that she was in, because of obviously she lost her brother, she's dealing with, or she's kind of failing at dealing with that grief. She's trying to connect, or her mother's trying to connect with her during all this time. We suddenly get Namor, pronounced differently by different characters. So I think we've
yes. got, you know. That was, I know.
I'm cool either way. I can go Namor. I might go both back and forth throughout the podcast. But, you know, we got him coming in and kind of, you know, making his statement. Man, let's talk about this dude. So Namor, there was a strong hope, I think, since the earliest days. And I think since some of the rumors had started getting around about a deleted scene or a potentially deleted scene from the first Black Panther of these wet footsteps walking up to the throne. Had you heard about this?
No, I've not.
Apparently this is something that maybe even Coogler like pitched, but then Feige was like, we're not quite ready to bring Namor in yet. And so there was always kind of this hype, this kind of like undertones of like, okay, we know that Namor's coming. We know that something's happening under the water. And there's, you know, could it very well be that this is going to lead to a war with Wakanda? And lo and behold, we finally kind of get that coming to fruition here. Now, this is a completely reimagining, almost completely reimagining of Namor, of, you know, the underwater city, which here they've renamed as Talakan, which is, completely reimagined as this. Was it Mayan, I want to say?
Yeah, because it was the set on the Yucatan Peninsula, so that would have been Mayan. Yes.
Yeah. It's very Mayan inspired in terms of like the, you know, the architecture and
oh, for sure.
And everything else. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
What was your knowledge of Namor kind of going into this? What was your, you know, thoughts on Namor? Like, what do you think, man, overall? Did this meet your expectations or did you even have any going in?
I did, right? So one of my biggest things that I wanted to see was his motivation. He is a character with just some really interesting layers and dynamics, right? You know, he is a character that throughout Marvel history, first and foremost, you know, of course, it's he's an Atlantean, you know, in the comics, and he is someone that is hyper vigilant and passionate about protecting his people and his homeland. And throughout his arc in the comics, it puts him in these very interesting positions where sometimes he is the straight up villain and other times he's an Avenger. You know, he's working with Captain America and Bucky in World War II, you know, against the Axis. And so I was really interested to see what the trigger would be for him to become Wakanda's enemy. That was my biggest thing that I wanted to see, how that would play out on screen for Namor.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I mean, he's always been very much kind of a one, like whatever he's focused in on, he is focused in on, he goes after it. Nothing else, you know, anything that gets in his way is going to get destroyed, or moved at best.
Yeah.
And what I thought was they did that was very interesting is that they made Namor charming. Like they gave him such a range. T'Nok, I want to say is the name of the actor. I think this is his first film that he's been a part of, and did a fantastic job of being charming, sympathetic. At times we see him very kind of kind, almost tender. These are mm-hmm. not aspects mm-hmm. that you would kind of like think when you know, if you're familiar with comic book Namor, you wouldn't really think of those.
Yeah, I mean he's the guy that at one point his own kingdom is like, listen, dude,
yeah,
you're too much, man. Like, you gotta go.
have a Snickers. You need to eat something or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. But at the same time, he still brought that ferocity, man. When he threatened, like when he kind of turned up the threat, especially on Ramunda, and like, I will come here. I will kill you. You know, like he's just being very clear about this is what I'm about to do. And I remember, and we'll get to it, but when he kills her in the throne room after attacking Wakanda and then just like, take care of your dad, I'm out. Like, I'm like, he did exactly what he said he was going to do. And
Stone cold, bro.
That's Namor channeling Namor. You know what I mean?
Like, so it's definitely, man. So you have this range of him being literally a ruthless killer, which is very consistent with his character. Like when other people at one point in the comics, you know, when other heroes and characters were hesitant to destroy one of the alternate Earths, you know, he did it. like he stepped up. He was like, I'll do it, you know, and without remorse. But then the scene where he and Shuri are together and the manner in which he engages her, I was like, wow, it's easy to dehumanize an insensitive, just, you know, sadistic villain, right? It's easy for us to do that. But when you see, like you said, the tender side, when you see reason, when you see compassion, and then when you are given a backstory that resonates deeply with you, seeing him literally from his birth, boyhood into manhood, it really made the difference. And then, you know, and then he kills Ramunda after you see that.
Yeah.
And you're like, what? So it's like, honestly, man, it feels like, you know, that part, like trying to just kind of just grapple with it. It just felt like a car that just kept shifting gears on you, you know,
man, like, yes.
And it really did. And, you know, my son and I were talking and just his whole thing, the manner in which he led the attack on Wakanda, right? When Thanos did it and it was the whole snap and everything that we saw, the way that we processed that was different because there was no element of finality to it. You know, you walked out of the theater and you're like, okay, a bunch of people turn into dust, but it's going to work out. Like they're going to come back. They're going to figure out a way.
Right, man.
It really gripped me because to watch Namor and the manner in which you're watching the kids on the street and families, there were people with like physical disabilities and things like that. And it was just ruthless. It was such a sense of finality to it. Like this is, you know, it was so serious, man. And it really gripped me sitting there. And I kind of, honestly, that left a lasting impression on me.
Yeah.
From the movie, probably almost more so than anything.
Man, I mean, do you think tied to your profession, like being kind of in a war zone that's a little bit more in?
Oh, for sure. That's it. Like that's exactly
urban
it.
Setting versus out in the field. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, for all of our listeners, you know, I'm just coming back from almost a year long tour overseas where, you know, in some of the environments that I was in, I was like in an urban setting and stuff like that. And so, yeah, Bo, that was just real.
Yeah.
Like,
no, that makes sense, man.
Yeah, for sure.
Cause that's the deal. Like with Thanos, it was literally the border. Like they were on the border of Wakanda. And so, and that shield, even it's like literally they punctured the shield and they got a little bit of ground and that's it. But you're right. Namor is like right there, right in the center, right in the capital, literally right on like outside the throne room. And okay. Oof, all right. I want to jump to this, but at the same time, I will jump to this, but then I want to circle back to Talakhan because I've got, you know, some thoughts around. I want to hear your thoughts around. Kind of the reimagining there. But all right. So he goes to the throne room. The big shock, I think, of this movie is the death of Ramunda.
Yes.
I have feelings about that, Aaron. Like, why? Okay. I have such complicated feelings about this movie. Was it important? Like, did they have to kill Ramunda? Would you think that was like legitimate? Because I was sitting there thinking, like, okay, because I guess Shuri needs to see somebody in the ancestral plane, or at least there needs to be a mystery of who she's going to see. But that already exists anyway, because we don't know how they're going to handle T'Challa. Did she have to die? Like, did they have to kill Ramonda? Like, did she have to die? Like, that's the thing.
I don't think she had to, man. I don't. As a matter of fact, when they're working to resuscitate her, I'm thinking, oh yeah, any minute, you know,
it's Wakanda.
She's gonna come back, like, and then when she doesn't, I'm like, guys, how much more can Shuri lose, man? what are we doing here? You know, in a way, I get it, but I don't think it was necessary.
I think it's going to be very hard, or at least I hope it is very hard for Namor to be seen as redeemable after this, because that puts it over the edge for him. That takes it. That takes away like a pillar of this franchise.
Listen. You bring up a very, very great point, because there is a point in time where there is an alliance that takes place between Shuri as Black Panther. It involves the Fantastic Four, War Machine, Monica Rambeau, you know, and against this, you know, very despotic character from Latveria.
Who did not show up in this movie, by the way.
Who did not show up. And so you're right. It's like, man, if they get together in the future, they got some stuff to work through, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I'm just thinking even from the standpoint of us as an audience, like, killing the Queen Mother is kind of a no. Just like,
No.
Like, there's so much loss already. Like, literally, it's just constant loss, death, death, death after death. And I get that that's to some extent the narrative, because there's a realness to that. But man, part of the beauty of what the franchise has been is the escapism of Wakanda. And it's like, there was no rebuilding from this movie of like a few, like a Wakanda where dreaming is like, you know what I mean? It felt like almost Wakanda without dreams is kind of what we ended up with at the end of the movie.
So to your point, at the beginning, when the queen is addressing the nations,
there
is such boldness and strategy and cunning and wisdom. And, you know, it was like, we know who we are. We know our place in this world and what we're capable of. And by the way, we know what you're capable of. Then you find out, wait a minute, there's another group of people who have vibranium. Uh-oh, you know?
Right.
Okay, now the playing field has been leveled, especially when Okoye is in that epic fight scene on the bridge, where the fierce warrior that she is, she's giving everything that she has, and where we would normally see her vanquish her enemies, be victorious, and move on with grace and style, she's bested in battle.
Yep.
And it's like, who are these people? And so the aura of invincibility around Wakanda, the advantage and the advancement as a result of their possession of vibranium, that's just poof, gone. And to watch them, the people from top to bottom, from the royal family down to the normal everyday Wakandan citizen, if you will, suffer and feel the effects of that, again, not on their borders, but within the heart of Wakanda, literally causing them to be refugees, was pretty, that was heavy. It was dark.
Oh, extremely. Man, you mentioned Okoye. She had a rough time this movie.
Whew.
That scene where Ramonda is like taking her to task. And it's like, because at first you're thinking like, I mean, like, it's Okoye. And then like she starts listing off like, oh yeah, no, that did happen. Oh yeah, no, that happened too. Oh man. You know, you just start to like the weight of, I don't even say her failure, but like the weight that Ramonda's been carrying. And it's like, you're the one. you are our protector and my family is dying off. And by the way, I'm going to be dead by the end of this movie. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Her performance, by the way,
Danai Gurira.
She gave a phenomenal performance, I think, throughout. I think for me, man, she was kind of the standout, honestly, performance overall. Angela Bassett had some incredible moments. The one that you referenced in particular was a highlight. But I just think, like, in many respects, this was kind of Okoye's movie from the weight that she had on all of her scenes.
Oh, yeah. That was, dude, I wanted to cry for her.
Oh, yeah.
In that scene, because she literally gave it all that she had, man. And she, remember what it felt like when her husband was so unfair to T'Challa for not bringing Claw back? He did everything that he could do. They were sabotaged by Killmonger. You know, he did everything that he said he would do, and yet it was held against him, and it was actually fuel to betray him. It was like, man, now that same dynamic, but in an opposite way, is being pushed to his wife.
Wow.
Pushed to Okoye.
Wow. Yeah, man.
You know, it's like, no, you don't understand. You were not there. You didn't see her given everything that she had, this warrior and guardian that she is to protect Shuri. Man, it was really hard. And when she put her spear into the floor there, and walked away, man, it was like, it was just a moment of grief.
But that's the thing, right? Like grief. Like, this was just like the constant throughout this movie. It was just like a hammering. I will say there was the levity that M'Baku did bring later on when he was talking about Shuri. It's like, oh, Shuri's, you know, she's, you know, been captured. She's like, oh, glory to Hanuman. I'm sure our queen will reward her by removing her.
By banishing her. Oh, man. No, that's, yeah, for sure.
All right, so let's talk about Riri, because, of course, all of this, you know, is kind of surrounding she's kind of the MacGuffin to some extent of this movie, right? Like, Namor is wanting to take her out because she has this way of tracking vibranium, and by removing her, she's no longer a threat to him, as well as Wakanda as well. So he sees this as he's trying to help both of them, and then also kind of, you know, doesn't want to get in the way of his larger efforts. Dominique Thorne, loved her. I gotta say, man, so much of the problems that I have with this movie, like if I'm going to get like into the nitpicking and just overall, really comes into the third act from a lot of different angles. And I liked her first suit. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Did you ever watch the Big Bad Beetleborgs back in the day, or was that a little after your time?
I was a little after. I'm vaguely familiar though.
I don't know why. I don't know if it was Feige or Coogler or whoever thought that calling Saban Entertainment to come and do like the suits for the third act of this movie. It was a little like the Midnight Angels. Like, everybody's super stoked for the Midnight Angels showing up. I was super stoked for them to be introduced. Those suits looked like they stepped off of Power Rangers circa like 1996. Like, this is, and we're in the 2020s, and we've had Thanos and we've had Iron Man, you know what I mean? Like, the special effects that Marvel has been putting out. I know that we have the post-pandemicness of everything going on, and I realize that's all kind of coming together and everything else, but man, I really felt like, I'm telling you, she looked like a big bad Beetleborg, and our listeners that know what I'm talking about know exactly what I'm talking about. And that was really disappointing.
Yeah, it wasn't a huge step forward in that aspect, for sure. I can't say that any better than you did.
I hate to say it. The Beetleborgs might have actually looked a little bit better, honestly, because I think that you could see kind of some, like, you know, rustication on their armor, whereas this one was a little too polished overall, and you know, it looks. I'm hoping that by the time that she gets to, like, I was very happy when Shuri's like, "You can't keep that suit." I was like, "Yes, Shuri, yes, thank you." Yes, she will. She will need a new suit. The Midnight Angels, I thought about it when we saw the costumes there too, and I was like, man, is this okay? Is all right? A big villain of Phase 4 as a whole, in my mind, has kind of been Disney Plus with some of the way that these series have maybe been causing a little bit of confusion for some people going into the movies, and then also kind of weirdly influencing perhaps some of the budgetary decisions. For example, maybe the reason the Midnight Angels costumes look like they were built on a TV budget is because they're made for an upcoming TV series.
You know, that's a good point.
Right? And it just seems like, I don't know, I wish a little bit more polish had been put. I mean, it's not just the costumes. I think go ahead.
Yeah, you brought it up, so I'm just going to say it. I'm not a big fan of the Disney Plus series. A lot of them. I feel like, so if they were going to be used as bridges, right? Or ways in which you could get these dynamic backstories and or teasers about what is to come, then I'm all about it. But I feel like overall, they've taken away from the MCU.
Yeah.
It strikes me, again, you know, it's just, you know, my opinion, as it's become a bit watered down. And so I don't know if that's kind of like an oversaturation effect, but it also, I believe, inhibits the ability to have that continued cohesiveness that the MCU has been known for in the past.
Yes, yes, yes.
Right? You know, the manner in which it was, you know, it was tight. It was the way in which they fed into each other and just fit together. And then I also think that the element of mystery is good, you know,
yeah.
For some of those things. And so, yeah, I'm with you 100% on that. That's my little Disney Plus soapbox. I'll get down.
It's good. I mean, like, it's been hit or miss. It has been definitely hit or miss. I think that I applaud them for trying something different. You know, I think that there's something to be said for leaning into kind of different ways in which we engage with story. And I think that's cool, but I think you're right. I think a better way of doing it is kind of like, you know, kind of expanding the universe through that, as opposed to like intersplicing some required viewing with some not required viewing and treating them both as if they're the same thing just makes for a bit of a confusing, you know, overall setup.
Yeah.
I will say this though, this to me, Wakanda Forever is the first Phase 4 movie that did not feel like a Phase 4 movie and felt a lot more like a Phase 2 or 3 movie.
For
like
sure.
I felt like we were re-entering into a world and a space that was familiar while also expanding it in the right kind of way. Whereas so much of Phase 4 has been, it's been new, which is good. I mean, new is good. I'm not opposed to it. I would actually argue that, like, overall right now in terms of Phase 4, I would say that Wakanda Forever, not accounting for Spider-Man No Way Home, which was really in a league of its own, like, Wakanda Forever really is like one of the more Marvelish movies. Like, it's probably top tier overall, but that's not quite saying much given where it falls in the overall layout of things.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about the world that they expanded here. So you mentioned, of course, that in the comics, Namor connected with Atlantis, a huge reimagining here by kind of transforming it into Talokan. What are your thoughts? Like, what did you, what was kind of your feelings there? Or, you know, did you think this take worked?
There's a way in which I appreciate what they did there, but I'm honestly, dude, I'm such a fan and a stickler about holding to the narrative in print.
Oh no.
In some ways, man. And I'm like, what's wrong with Atlantis? Like, again, the manner in which they portrayed it, right? I think it was great. It was depth, it was backstory, it was realistic historical context that resonated. There was an expansion in terms of ethnic representation and all of those things, and just bringing in more aspects. I get it, but I do have mixed feelings about it. You know, I can't say that I'm sold.
It is interesting. It felt like they were trying to do with kind of this reimagining of Atlantis, kind of create this kind of an alternate Wakanda, like a Mexican Wakanda to some extent.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I'll just go ahead and say it like that. That's what it felt like they were trying to do. And, you know, I think regardless of whether or not it was successful, my biggest challenge, this is going to sound so dumb, is that it's underwater. I had such a hard time. Like, I'm serious, because like everybody's floating around. So it does, like, and it's like, oh, okay. Now okay. Like, it's just, I don't know. It felt like, you know, even like Shuri, as she's like floating around through the city in the pressure suit, which makes sense. It all makes sense. But it was kind of dark and underwater. I don't, you know, you and I, we play video games, and in video games, there's always like some kind of like underwater level they introduce. It is always my least favorite level every single time. So I guess I just really had a hard time getting that same sense. Whereas Wakanda felt like this special uncolonized kind of place in which the world could not get to. Like Talakan felt more like a hiding place to some extent. I mean, like it felt like literally.
So you bring up a great point. So when he's taking her there, they're going deeper, and I'm like, then deeper, you know, then deeper. right. And then when they're going over that crest, I'm like, all right, what are we gonna see? You know, I'm still in Atlantis mode, right?
Right.
So, and I'm thinking it's just going to be this beautiful, immaculate, you know, and I'm not saying that it wasn't beautiful, but because it really was, for what it was represented and all of those things, but it just, I was like, all right, don't take, all right. So it's going to sound funny, bro. I was like, is this like an underwater Zion? What is this like?
We are still here.
You know what I'm saying? Like, what are we doing, man? You know,
the machines are trying to find us. They're drilling down.
It really did strike me like that, man. Wow. That's the first place my mind went, bro. You know, but again, that's my head.
I will say this. I mean, like to the credit of what they're doing here, I think it's interesting because whereas Wakanda, like. The notion was this is a world, this was a space, a place, a nation that was never colonized, that was never, you know, touched by the outside world. Talakan is literally a people who have been forced out of their homes and trying to find, you know what I mean? So it's a very different mindset there.
The other thing, that way it makes perfect sense.
Absolutely. And I mean, you even think about like the architecture, the technology, because I was sitting there in the theater. I was like, man, okay, so y'all been down here for a long time, but you haven't really updated anything. Like this looks like you just kind of plopped kind of an Aztec, all of these different kind of architectural places and kind of plopped them under sea. And there, we haven't seen like a nation of people that have kind of innovated. And that's really like, whereas you go to Wakanda and it's Afrofuturism, you know what I mean? Like it's completely it's again, the beauty of Wakanda in the first movie is that it was this almost pseudo dream world, right? Like it gave the space to dream about what advancement looks like without kind of the colonizing history of the rest of the planet, right? And so I don't know. I've had a hard time connecting with Talakan as a whole.
Yeah, definitely so my expectations were just different, and the manner in which Wakanda is portrayed and the manner in which Talakan is portrayed, I just thought there would be like that same kind of feel to it. Like, man, this is just this amazing, you know. But for, according to that particular narrative, for a place that was birthed in isolation, a forced isolation,
right, exactly.
Versus a place that was founded, you know, the history of Wakanda founded upon this amazing substance, you know, the most advanced substance known to humanity, and the manner in which society, technology, and the entire system and way of life was built upon. Yeah, definitely a big difference.
Yeah, and I mean, Talakan had that too, right? Because they had it underwater. But even then, it's like, I just have so many questions. I feel I could use a Disney Plus series explaining a little bit more as to what's going on.
They're gonna do it.
They probably will. But I mean, like, you know, this being said, you know, our Latin listeners might like say, like, oh, you know, you are totally missing X, Y, and Z. And if so, by all means, let us know that we may have missed.
You know, that's a great point.
Yeah. We talked about all but I think two characters that we really need to dive into here. And let's first go to the return briefly of Michael B. Jordan from the ancestral plane. So as we are turning the corner, you know, Shiri, she's created the synthetic heart-shaped herb. She's doing the ritual. And by the way, just the whole scene around that is fantastic. Like, she's like, no, you don't have to do all the special stuff. Like, you know, like, and yet at the same time you see like Nakia is still like putting the chants in and like inviting Riri into doing the chants as well. It's like this really, it's very interesting. They perform the ritual. She goes into the ancestral plane. We see her, she's in the throne room, which has a lot that could potentially be unpacked. We see that somebody is sitting in the throne. Aaron, when she started turning, what did you expect to see?
Listen.
Who or what did you expect to see in that chair?
My heart probably beat the fastest during that scene.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything up until that point that we had seen about the ancestral plane, like even, you know, how beautiful T'Challa's first scene was there. And just how packed with meaning and inspiration and beauty and legacy, and even Killmonger.
Yeah.
For him, it was a scene that humanized him. And you saw him as a son and not as a mercenary.
He saw himself that way,
right? So I'm looking and I'm like, okay, I don't see the outline of the queen's headdress, right?
I'm like, man,
did they do something? Did they do something with Chadwick? Did they do something? Like, how are they going to, you know, like, I was like, what's going to, and then it was him, bro. That was the biggest curveball I've ever been thrown. In a movie, you know, because you consume enough entertainment. We like to pride ourselves on, I can see where this is going, and I think I can figure this out. Bro, I did not see that coming. I didn't see anything about that scene coming. It was jolting.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, so I think the choice for it to be Killmonger was fantastic. And I was right there with you because my heart was beating as well because I was like, they better not have done like a CGI Chadwick.
Yeah, dude.
I was not going to be okay with that.
Well, like, it'd be like, you know, I don't want to use the term lightly, but like sacrilegious. You know?
Dude, that's what, yes, exactly. And like, that's why I was like, because of the way that I was kind of feeling already very conflicted about like what I've shared before about the mouse monetizing, you know, grief around Chadwick's death. Like, I was like, They did not. I won't walk out because I want to see the movie. But I will want to walk out. And of course, but then there's also that achingness of like, but I do kind of want to see him. Like, I really kind of want Shuri to be with T'Challa right now. And so, of course, they turned the corner, and like you said, the biggest like curveball. And I had a suspicion that that character was going to pop up somewhere, and it made sense that this would be the moment.
So she is, you know, part of the background of Shuri's character is that I think the portrayal of her, again, as a little girl, genius, playful kind of thing, you know, detracted from, was that she is someone who has a very strong sense of justice.
Yes.
And, you know, she's a wild card. And with that sense of justice, it did make great sense that honestly, dude, this is the first time that I saw the heart-shaped herb have like a ring effect, if you will, right? Where it's about like bringing out your deep desires.
Oh,
you know,
interesting.
You know, that you can't, you know, like T'Challa desired to see his father, and that's who he got to meet. Well, Killmonger desired, you know, that's what drove him.
So,
and he saw his father. And so you got to see the reality of how strong that sense of justice and what had become this like fierce vengefulness in Shuri, and it manifested in her seeing Killmonger.
That's like, wild. I had never thought about it from that, but you were so right. Like she, like it's that grief. We see that she can't figure out what to do with her grief. And so when she goes to that moment of the heart-shaped herb of the ancestral plane, more than wanting to see her brother, she wants something to do with this grief.
Mm-hmm. And it worked. like after the initial shock, the you know, the way he engages her and what he says, I was like, this makes sense.
I need to rewatch this scene. Because I remember afterwards thinking like, I don't know. Shuri is kind of like a second Killmonger type. I don't really see, like, I get it. She's mad, but like, I was having a hard time like seeing, it felt more story driven than character driven in that moment for me. And so I was struggling with that, but I hadn't really considered what was going on from that standpoint. And so I might need to rewatch this scene.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. It was shot beautifully.
For sure.
The throne room on fire, of course, very reminiscent of, you know, Killmonger burning the heart-shaped herb. Fantastic. Well used cameo. very much a cameo, but very much well used.
Yes. Yes.
All right. And then finally, man, we got to talk about Nakia. Nakia, of course, brought back in, very much missed, I think, in the first part of this movie. Glad when she did show back up. I think a lot of folks were kind of hoping, speaking of that heart-shaped herb scene, that she would actually be the one to take it, which I love Lupita too. Like, don't get me wrong, but I also understand, like, Nakia's not going to become the Black Panther.
No.
Yeah.
She has no desire to stay within the borders of Wakanda.
Exactly. Like, that's not her thing at all. Like, literally she left. Obviously she comes into the movie at a crucial time. She's, you know, kind of that, you know, returned back to, you know, at the turn of the tide, right? She's here. Mm-hmm. They need a protector. They need somebody to go get their princess. She comes in, she saves the day. She helps Shuri along, gives her a pep talk, helps, you know, set her back on the right path, and is in many respects her family. She is essentially a sister-in-law to her, regardless of, you know, how well she might know that. And so seeing, we needed more family, because so much family is lost throughout this movie. And so seeing that connection, I think, was really important. That being said, the choice, I'm assuming you stayed for the end credits.
Yes, I did.
Okay. All right. So, you know, obviously at the end of this movie, we discover that sometime pre-snap, if I'm doing my math correctly.
Yeah.
It would seem that Nakia and T'Challa had a son, a secret son that even Shuri didn't know about. But Ramunda clearly did. You know, there was that moment actually right before she died. She was like, "There's something you need to know about your brother." I had forgotten about that line right until that moment. I was like, oh yeah, I bet this was it. So what are your thoughts, man? We've got T'Challa Jr.
Well, okay, man, from a sentimental standpoint, you know, it really tugged at my heartstrings, right? In terms of like, wow, you know, this is like, especially when she says, you know, he tells her who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "I am Prince T'Challa, son of King T'Challa."
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was... Yeah, it was a pretty cool moment, man, for sure. And I don't know if I'm a fan, though. all the way, right? And I know that may sound a little weird to some people who are listening, but, you know, again, you know, because I'm just kind of, you know, I'm real rigid in my, like, again, you know, stickler for the prince of all that. Anyway, so it was a beautiful moment. What made it beautiful was it continued the theme of legacy. Not only did it continue the theme of legacy, but we see Shuri get to grieve. And then we get to see her with her nephew, like this sense of hope for the future and a major part of her brother remaining after she had lost both her brother and her mom.
Right. It's the gift of family after we've lost so
right?
much family.
Right. Yeah, like that part was really, really, really just awesome. The part that I found, like, again, I'm like, okay, so what are y'all going to do with this though? That was like, that was my thought. So like, beautiful moment. And I really did appreciate it. But my mixed feelings come from like, what are we going to do with this in the future? Because now you've written a son into the narrative.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't write him out now. Like we, you know, and so you've written a son into the narrative and, you know, I've got like, and so I'll share a quick theory, then I'll toss it back to you. But okay, so here's the thing. We have seen this massive youth movement in these in phase four that begin in yes. phase four, right? Yes. This massive youth movement with torches being passed, batons being passed, however you want to, you know, phrase yeah. it. Yeah. We've been witnessing that. And I'm thinking, all right, are they like, and then with the introduction of Ironheart, I'm like, are we going for a young Avengers kind of?
Oh, definitely. You
know, like,
definitely.
Like, yeah, so are we about to push the young Avengers? That's going to be the next Disney Plus series.
mm-hmm. No, I mean, I hope that's the next movie franchise, hopefully. But I think
that was my thought coming out of it, you know, that my mixed feelings, you know, like it was, you know, it was a setup, like, what are you going to do? You know, but then I was like, okay, young Avengers, that's where my mind went.
Okay. See, okay. This, yes, it feels like, it felt like a business decision. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, like I agree the cathartic moment that provided for Shuri and, you know, seeing her kind of, you know, even though she's the aunt, like there's this, like this big sister, little brother type of energy that's kind of reflecting on, you know, what she had with her brother. And that was, it was precious and it was sweet and it was tender. And after so much loss, I remember when my wife's brother died of cancer, like right before my eldest daughter was born. And this combination of kind of the grief of loss of family that's mixed in with the joy of like this entering a new family, it's life, you know, it's like literally life all coming together.
Yes, yes, for sure.
But it felt like we need another T'Challa, Marvel Incorporated, Disney, you know, Walt Disney.
Yeah,
and so therefore, because here's the thing, I cannot believe that T'Challa that we saw from Black Panther had a secret child that he kept away from Wakanda after all that mess with Killmonger.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, what? What? Like, I'm sure there's a great retcon explanation for what they'll Disney Plus, but still, like, I'm like, wait a minute now. We had this whole movie about like Wakandan children, like growing up outside of Wakanda.
Mm-hmm.
And like who could have Killmonger been had he been raised as the prince that he was?
Exactly.
And so I get it, the kid knows he's a prince, but so did Killmonger. And I get it, he's in Haiti, so he's in Haiti, all right. Mm-hmm. So he was
Oakland, he was on the Oakland, west coast, the bay,
right. Yeah, so not in Oakland, you know, so I get it, different, but still that just doesn't seem, I can't I have a hard time, like, oh, we wanted him to grow up away from the pressures of the pressure of the throne. I'm like, wait, what? No,
listen, no.
Wakanda kings and queens are raised for that, like prepared for that. Like that's a feature, not a bug. I'm just, I think that was a weird decision.
Out of all the theories that we had, would they recast the character? Would they resurrect Killmonger? Would it be M'Baku? Then it's like, I was like, they chose to, and then to have the same name,
that's
to have the same. And I'm like, that's how they recast him.
Yep.
They recast T'Challa by him having a son. But when you do begin to peel back and look at the, it doesn't make a lot of sense in some ways, you know, when you start to like, okay, but this happened. And, you know, because even watching, so we knew that T'Challa and Nakia, they cared for each other deeply, you know? Yeah. But personally, I was always left with the impression that it was a deep friendship, but there was also a mutual understanding that as much as they cared for each other, it just wasn't going to work.
Right.
You know, and it was, you know, mutual respect and admiration and understanding in terms of their arcs in life and ambitions and goals and identities. And it just wasn't going to work. And so, yeah, for them to have the secret child, it just doesn't jive with the rest of the things that had taken place up until that point, and the dynamics that we had witnessed, and the arcs and developments, and the leanings of the characters that we had seen up until that point.
Yeah. It's. So, I mean, hey, you know, but at the same time, maybe we'll get a, you know, Black Panther and the Young Avengers. You know, I mean, that's not a bad thing.
Maybe. He's going to have to end up getting with the, you know,
Young Storm.
Okay.
Young Storm. Like, yeah. Exactly.
You already knew what I was going to say.
Exactly. I think literally everybody who knew what was up, like, walked out of that, like, ah, and that's how T'Challa ends up with Storm. Okay. All right.
Yep.
You cast Lupita as Nakia, and now nobody wants him to end up with anybody than Nakia.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay.
All right, I see it. All right, that makes sense. All right, so they do, man, this is where, you know, it all kind of all comes to an end. We see Shuri has essentially abdicated the throne. M'Baku, it appears that he is now the king of Wakanda, which is an interesting layout. I think you mentioned that particular world leader from Latveria who may or may not be popping up in the near future. I do think an allyship of Namor and Talokan with an M'Baku-led Wakanda versus Latveria would be a very interesting story
for sure.
To explore.
For sure.
And so, you know, we'll see where that ends up taking us. But overall, man, curious, out of 5, what would you give it?
Out of 5? I'd give it 4.
Okay. I feel so conflicted about it. That third act was rough, man. Like, the battle scene was an odd choice.
It was very odd.
The first two, like, that's the thing. The first two acts I really enjoyed. I loved getting back into Wakanda, even in the midst of all the grief. There was still so much beauty and so much, like, you know, just exploring the world, seeing, you know, Ramunda, especially, like, interacting with the UN was fantastic.
Yeah.
Shuri's journey of, like, early on, I was really there for. I thought that was really powerful. I liked Riri. I know some people didn't like Riri. I liked Riri. And I think with more time, she could do some really great things with the character.
Yes.
But, I think after they killed Ramunda, I was like, I don't know how I feel about this movie anymore.
Yeah. I know we don't have time. We didn't get into the fight scene.
No, man, we've gone way too long. Look, hopefully we'll get a chance to revisit, and we need to give Tyler a chance to share his thoughts as well. So
I know he has lots.
Oh, come on. He's probably listening to this just, like, yelling at us right now. Also, Martin Freeman and Julie Louise Dreyfus were also in this movie. All right, man, this was so much fun. Really enjoyed getting that chance. Look,
real quick, bro, I just want to tell our listeners, if you go back and you listen to previous episodes, we called this before it ever even happened. When we were watching Endgame and they talked about the earthquakes beneath the surface of the water at sea,
yes,
I was like,
yes,
there it is. And people looked at me like I was crazy, but it happened. Anyway, all right, I had to get off my chest.
No, that's good. That's good, man. That's absolutely good. Well, hey, hopefully y'all enjoyed this. Be sure to leave us a review on iTunes and all that kind of great stuff. Be sure to check out the Witness BCC for more content. Man, Aaron, it is so good to hear your voice and for you to be back stateside. And man, just love you so much, brother. Thank you so much for making the time, and I appreciate you. I mean, hey, this is your show as much. I don't know why I'm acting like this. I just feel like I haven't seen you in forever.
Listen, it's so good to be back, bro. It's so good to be back and safe and sound.
You know, so overall, it's a complicated movie, but we really enjoyed talking about it. So, hey, Aaron, Wakanda forever.
Wakanda forever.